Thank you for taking a ride on the Freedom Train podcast series. Today, I'm by myself, but you know who I am, your conductor, Joseph Ward. And remember, the Freedom Train podcast series is brought to you by PAX Inc. That's P-A-C-P-S-I-N-C. And PAX Inc. is a black development organization aimed at developing the black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with the traits of hard work, honesty, and integrity. For more information, make sure you visit www.pactsinc.org to learn more about PAX Inc. and everything that they bring to the community. While you're online, make sure you visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com to learn more about myself, Joseph Ward, as well as my co-host Patrick Irvin and Jamie Basham, as well as all of the other hosts of the podcast on the Freedom Train Network. Remember, every Monday you have the Fix Sports Podcast. Every Wednesday you have the Freedom Train Podcast Series, as well as the live showing of Office Hours with Professor Carl Tone Jones and Erica Tolbert. Every Thursday you have Lessons from the Screen with Patrick Irvin. Every Friday you have the podcast of the Office Hours with Professor Carl Thorne Jones and Erica Tolbert, which is also available on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. You also have Tea Time Black Women Talk every Friday coming out. And every Saturday, remember, you have the On the Shoulders of Giants podcast that's available on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. So today on the Freedom Train, we have a man who's been instrumental in my life, whether he may know it or not. When I first got to the campus of Florida A&M University, as a young man in the world, trying to find my place, trying to understand what was going on, my intentions when I got to college was to play football, go to the NFL, and, you know, the usual dream of a young black man coming from poverty. That didn't happen, and so I began taking specific classes. One of the classes was black psychology. I took a industrial psychology class. I took a class that was the psychology of racism and prejudice. But one thing that was constant in these classes was that strong black male intellect presence. And it was one of the first times that I saw a black man who was strong in his will, strong in his presence, masterful in his words. His articulation was on point, and he didn't sound like a white man. So that kind of blew my mind. So it's one of the first times I got a chance to see that strong black male presence. But the information that I learned helped me to love myself as a black man and come into the realization of what we're really dealing with when we're dealing with white supremacy, as you can tell what we talk about on this line. So this man that I have on the line today is one of the best instructors I've ever had in my life. He's a great model in the city here in Tallahassee. He backs up his words. He doesn't just talk the talk. He walks the walk. I've had the great pleasure of watching him since I was 19 years old. I'm 34 now, so I've been able to watch him, what he does in the community, how he interacts in the community, the impact he makes in the community, and the way our community members respond to him. And as I can say from my personal stance, he was the reason I read the book The ISIS Papers. He was the reason I read the book Crow Dog. And he's one of the reasons why I continue my readings today. And I want to bring to you all one of the best men I've met in my life, Dr. Dana Denard. Thank you. Welcome to the Freedom Train.
Thank you very much, sir. Respect.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
All respect to you, sir. Thank you.
No, respect to you, because you have really made an impact, like I said, on my life, and I know the life of others around here in Tallahassee that's in my age range. And we do want to make sure that we honor people like you who really have laid a great foundation for us to stand on, and it's just on us to take it forward into the future. So thank you for being here and giving us your time.
I tell you, the thing is that anything that I have been able to accomplish in the way that I live, any help that I have been able to offer anyone, is in many ways, we must understand it's a reflection of, first of all, where I came from, the people I came from. So I came from a tradition of black people who were teachers and who were about excellence, and they put that in me. And then that caused me to seek out other people of excellence who also were in some way or some fashion mentors to me. So, you know, I don't exist in a vacuum. You know, we don't exist in a vacuum. And my good that I am able to bring is definitely a reflection of my deepest and deepest respect for my grandparents, my great-grandparents, my mother, and my uncles and aunts, first of all, and also the fact that I had just remarkable mentors. I literally was mentored by Martin Luther King personally, and he had such a great impact on me. I was 12 years old then, and so he had such a great impact on me, and one thing that he taught me was to be fearless, and so a lot of what I do is based on the fact that I had these mentors that mm-hmm. helped me to understand the vital value of being alive, and especially in the time and the place we are right now. So all of those nice things you said, you know, I appreciate it and respect you, and I will accept and receive it on behalf of all of these people that have influenced me.
Thank you. I thank you very much. Yes, sir. So let's get into I want to learn more about you and let our audience learn more about you. So can you give us some background information about yourself and what led you to the works that you do here in this Tallahassee community?
Well, that's a very, very long story. I'll make it as short as I can. First of all, I was conceived in Tallahassee. I'm a college baby.
Okay.
I was born in St. Petersburg, Florida, and raised in St. Petersburg, Florida, most of my life, although my mother ended up being a single mother, and she ended up moving about as a teacher. She moved about where she could get better pay.
Right.
And so a lot of it is the, you know, the family dynamic that I came from in St. Petersburg. We were a very extended family, like I said. Excuse me. Like I said, I grew up with my great-grandparents still living.
Right.
They lived until I was in high school. So, you know, my great-grandparents were together, and they ran the clan, and my great-grandmother was the final word on all things in our clan. And, you know, we were doing family reunion back in the 60s before it became, like, a popular thing. And so I had all this this whole thing of a social world, you know, where people in those days were black people. First of all, we knew what the situation was because it was separate and unequal. I grew up in the age of separate and unequal. Mm-hmm. I grew up with the two bathrooms and the different water fountains and all of that. That was all a part of my life. And so, you know, my relatives really made it clear to us that, you know, it was an unequal situation and that we had better be serious about our lives and put forth all the effort to be, as they used to say, you got to be three times better because you have strikes against you already by showing up black. So
right.
That was a lot of the impetus that led me towards being a striver, or what we call even a stalker of knowledge. You know, to just really be very focused on gaining knowledge. And I went to college my first year. I failed college my first year. I kind of went crazy, I would say.
Yeah.
And it did, you know, got involved in the drug scene and all that. And so I actually went into therapy and the drug treatment at the age of 18. And I stayed in that program, and then I ended up becoming a counselor. And so I was actually a paraprofessional counselor at the age of 18. And I did that for a year and a half. That's all I did. And that's where I got my interest in psychology. And then I went and formally studied psychology. And while I was involved in graduate school in psychology, I was at Florida State. I met Dr. Naeem Akbar, who at the time was the first black psychologist I ever met. And we had a long talk that summer. It was my first year of grad school. And he was explaining to me the importance of getting my second education while I was getting my PhD. And he said to me, he said, you know, you'll never get papers or a degree, you know, for this second education, but it'll be more important. And that was my education in African history and culture. And so I earnestly began to study. I probably studied maybe even more African history and culture than I did psychology. And so even though I don't have a degree in African history and culture, I probably could stand my ground very well with anybody in that area because I did a lot of study in African history and culture. And then an interesting thing happened to me when I finished graduate school. I was out in Los Angeles, and I went to look for a job, and I ended up getting a job running a hospital out there. And it was a psychiatric hospital, but it was for people who were involved in substance abuse. And there I kind of found my role, I say. I sort of found my purpose, you know. It was 99% African-American population. They were very young people. Most of them were under the age of 25. And I realized that we were just losing young people left and right, just to drug abuse alone. That was during the crack epidemic, and most of them were crack addicts. And then I was invited to speak at NA meeting in L.A. one night, and there were like over 500 people who were there at the meeting all trying to get off crack. And I just realized that, wow, you know, this is so devastating. I really need to put my attention on really developing young people to embrace this war against us, you know, and embrace the idea of being a warrior, you know. And I was offered a job to come back to FAMU and teach, and I thought, well, that would be the perfect situation for me to go back to FAMU and to try to develop some warriors, all the young people going to college, and try to help them to understand that, you know, it's really not about finding a job. It's really about finding your mind. So that's what got me on this path, and I've been on it ever since. And I just take everything from every direction of life that I have been exposed to and look at what can I do to try to help influence people to be more serious about life, to help them be more informed. Because, you know, they say you know more and you know better, you do better. So I kind of became the person that was my job. And so that's how I ended up with the bookstore. It was our first thing to do in Tallahassee. We know that we as African Americans have been miseducated.
Yes,
but really,
yes, yes.
The whole population of America has been miseducated. But part of our issue is we are miseducated. And we also are outside of our natural cultural frame of reference. So the bookstore was our first intervention at a community level to give people an opportunity to get more information. Because, of course, I certainly was being influenced by all the new information that I was learning about African history and culture. And that's probably the number one issue that affects the mental health of African American people is the fact that we don't know what happened. And so that bookstore became kind of like the hub in Tallahassee of people who were realizing the importance of African history and culture. And we just went from there to continue to expand our reach into the community and to try to bring some light to our understanding.
You all have definitely, I feel, have definitely done a great job of setting that example of what it is to truly learn the information, be able to digest the information, understand it, and practically use it to improve yourself and your community. And because I talk about it with some of my friends a lot about how we have some people who do consume the information, but there's not a lot of action that comes after the information is consumed. So I feel blessed that I was in a space with people like yourself, Dr. Jackson Lohman, and others who kind of put that into us yes, we have the information. You're in a psychology program, but you're also going to learn this African history, and we're going to teach you how to utilize it. So I definitely feel like you did a good job of that there. So, yes, sir. So,
well,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Part of the mental aspect of what has happened with, what we're calling white supremacy domination,
mm-hmm.
is the realization that we have been forced to be dependent
right.
on white folks for our very existence for several hundred years. So we understand that, getting information is a part of it. That's a bridge. But like all bridges, a bridge doesn't matter unless you're walking. You got to walk
yes, sir.
Across the bridge.
Yes.
And then once you get across the bridge and you get to an area or a space where you can really live differently, then it becomes your responsibility to live differently. See, so even though we have in our population, we have many, many people who have achieved a certain level of, how should we say, skill development
mm-hmm.
within our community. That doesn't mean that we've dealt with the mental aspect of dependency. And that is still the biggest problem is in our community, is in spite of the fact that we have people with all kinds of skills, whether they be doctors and lawyers and whatever, computer experts, whatever, the point is that doesn't mean that we necessarily solve our problems with those skills. So if we look at the education system, what we may have, in fact, we may have many of our people in the education system, and they may have great intelligence and understanding of what to do. But again, that doesn't mean that they're actually going to do it, because the bottom line is that we do not know how to run our own lives anymore. We haven't been doing it. And so we are psychologically still in a state of dependency. And when you're dependent, you look towards those who have controlled you to answer your questions, to come up with solutions. And so we end up using most of our talent, our intelligence, and our energy solving the problem of our oppressor. There's different problems,
right.
whether it be military,
right.
whether it be medical, whatever it is, even in psychology. One of the things that I had to learn early on in my first year of graduate school is a lot of the things that we were taught in grad school that we learned that I, in fact, employed and used with therapy with white folks doesn't work with black people, see? So
mm-hmm.
that means I had to learn, well, what does work with black people, see? How it is the formula, and it's a different formula, and we find that's true for medications and all kinds of things. So, we've been in a situation where different has always been about superiority and inferiority. That's the game that's been played with us about difference. And so now, as we're becoming more sophisticated and realizing that, hey, in many ways we really are different, we really aren't the same. And people want to shun the intelligence about difference because they are so used to difference equaling superior and inferior, when in fact difference is just difference. So there are different things that we need to do. So one of the things that we did, I saw that when I was in the school system. As a psychologist, I've been to all of these schools in North Florida, in 14 counties in North Florida, all the way to Bay County, Jefferson mm-hmm. County, Taylor County, et cetera, Washington, all these different counties, Jackson. I've been to all these schools in all these counties. And I was just appalled at what I saw going on in these schools, especially as related to black male children, especially. Now, we as a community, we have been seeing these numbers. We've been listening to our children complain, but the truth is we haven't responded to the actual condition of our situation. We really haven't. And that's how I ended up developing my own school. I ran a school for 17 years. My children went to my school, and some other children did. We outperformed public school 3 to 5 years. Most of my children were 3 or 5 years ahead of public school. But in spite of that, as a rule, again, most of our children are where? They're in those same schools. I call them the killing fields, where we
right.
send our children out to these schools. where the school system itself is not set up to promote the well-being of black children. It's set up to promote the well-being of white children. Right. And many times, and it doesn't mean that, you know, a teacher in the school system is necessarily hostile towards black children. I'm not saying that. I'm saying the teacher, even if she really is concerned about black children, it's usually a she, it's not usually a he, and even if she is, that doesn't mean that she actually knows how to reach black children, see? She's simply following the script that she's been given, and the script is for the elevation of white children, not all the other children. And so right. This is a fact, this is our situation, and I'm saying you would think at this point that with all of us, with all these degrees and all this education that we have, that we would have created our own education system for our children, but we haven't done that. And that's kind of where we are, and that's what I'm saying. This dependency, psychological dependency on the oppressor, we're still very much stuck there. And so what we try to do is we try to show a model of how it can be, how we can exist in a truly hostile world, how we can exist, right. How we can expand and, create reality in our own image and our own interests, which our interest is survival at the highest level, not just to get by, not just to have a job, but rather to thrive at the highest level. We try to model that so that at least the young people, when they come along, they can see an alternative.
Yes, sir. And speaking of that psychological dependence, because my co-host and I, we always have conversations about black progress versus white progress, and most of the things that we celebrate as black progress is truly white progress. But also to be able to challenge that dependency, entrepreneurship, in my opinion, is that's where that would come in from our community. And you've already spoke briefly about it within your own career. But how important is entrepreneurship to our community? And in your opinion, what are the benefits that will help us be able to break those chains of dependency?
Well, that's the crux of it, and that's like the most important aspect of it.
Right.
Because you see, when I was talking about dependency, I'm saying we're not noticing that in human history, you know, human beings on this planet, and we're the oldest human beings on this planet, that it all started out where people had to create their reality. They had to produce everything that they needed, you see. There was no Publix. There was no Walmart. There was no Amazon. You couldn't get on the phone and just say, you know, send me a burger.
Right.
I mean, people had to actually literally produce everything they needed. And so over time, people realized that, well, they could share with each other. And so if I have produced, you know, a bushel of rye or wheat or rice or whatever, and you've got mango trees and bananas over there, well, we can exchange. We can trade, you know. In other words, I come with what I produce, and you come with what you produce, and then we support each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this exchange is where the term currency comes from, how the energy of life is being transferred from one group to the next, or one person to the next, you see?
Mm-hmm.
So now people are under the illusion that currency is a physical object like money.
Right.
Or even electron transfer in from bank to bank. But, I mean, you have a bank because you have something in the bank. That's why you have a bank. And so, again, when we become dependent, there is no transfer, you see. There's only waiting. We're waiting for someone to produce for us so that we can be alive. And that is an insane position to be in. And that is the foundation of slavery. And so if we are not creating our own currency, then we are not in a position to survive at our highest level. So that requires us to actually do things.
Right.
And so to generate what we need, you see. And so, you know, if we are out of jobs, let's say we don't have jobs, right? It's an interesting thing to see how we will say we're out of jobs, right? But then again, let's look at the actual situation of our lives. If we're out of jobs, what we still need, what? We need food. We still need to have access to drinking water. Yeah. We still need to have access to shelter. That's minimum, right? Okay. We don't have food. Okay. Are we growing food? You see? How could you be out of a job and then you need food, but you're not growing food?
Right.
You see? We like nice things. You know, if you go into a furniture store, you know, you go into almost anybody's home, they got furniture in there.
Correct.
It could be a little bit of furniture to a whole lot of furniture. We like nice things, right? Okay, where's the black furniture store? Where's the black people making furniture, right? So if you have a black furniture store and you're making furniture, you're also making jobs.
Correct.
You're also making a situation, a context where you can actually survive and support each other, right? Most of the jobs in the United States are created by small business. They're not created by big business like Walmart and, you know, even the rest of it would be the government, right? But people don't realize that most of the jobs in the United States are really created by small business. So if you don't have business, right, then that means you're automatically in a state of dependency because that means you're not producing things.
Right.
Which, so that means you don't have that rye or that corn or whatever to bring to the table. So you're in a bad place already. And when you don't have business, then you don't have financial support. And when you don't have financial support, then you don't have political support. And when you don't have political support, then you don't have political influence. And when you don't have political influence, you are forced to accept the situation as it is given to you. So you can march and march and march and scream and dislike and complain and go on TV and be on Facebook and do all of those things that you want to. But the bottom line is what you'll notice is that the people in power respond to the people who are in business.
Yes,
that's the bottom line.
Yes, they do.
Because the people in business are generating the things that the people need. And human beings will respond to their needs before everything else.
That is.
So
that
we're
is,
not doing that, right? We're not doing that, and we that's only because we have been psychologically displaced from our natural order. Because, of course, if we look at history, we will see we can go all the way back to the beginning, up until really only about 400 years ago. We will see that we were the people who produced almost everything that was being produced. And we certainly produced it for ourselves. And even now, you know, one of my favorite and most important mentors was Dr. John Henry Clark.
Yes.
And Dr. Clark used to always point out, you know, we're in a restaurant cooking somebody else's food with somebody. We're the tailor. We're making clothes down at the shop where they make clothes. We're in the factory running machines for somebody else that they made to create a product that they have control over. I mean, we're in every corner of the world doing the things that have to be done to make sure that the products come about. And yet, we're not doing that for ourselves.
Right.
See? So, We have to reorient ourselves back to being producers rather than simply being consumers. So you're absolutely right. The avenue to being producers is definitely business and business production, definitely.
That's it. So and this question is off the beaten path, but you've mentioned two very influential, iconic men who were mentors of yours, Dr. King and Dr. Clark. And Dr. Clark and He and J.A. Rogers are two of my favorite historians. And
yes,
so,
absolutely.
Because we have, I feel in this day and time, with so much access to information, especially people my age and younger and some older, we have the, like I said earlier, we have the information but no understanding. So I want to know from you, how important is that influence, that mentor, that guy? How important are those persons in the lives of those who are coming into the understanding, coming into the information, to be able to help them really utilize the information rather than just gather the information, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that is a very, very important point. That's one of the key elements to becoming a successful person,
yes,
is the realization that you need a mentor and
mm-hmm.
hooking up with a mentor. And I said before that with all that I have done and do, it's not out of context. You know, it's not out of space. You didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, I am simply following the leads that I have been given from various people. Those are just two of the giants. I was fortunate, you know, that's the grace of God. That's the only way we can describe it, that I was exposed to these giants, and I was exposed to some other giants out there. Never met J.A. Rogers. Of course, you know, he's from my era of the world, but I did read all of his works. And the thing is that what you're really talking about is a learning method, again, that was a part of our tradition, which is what we call the apprenticeship relationship method. So that in all learning, what you had is sort of like sometimes if people go and they'll do a certain type of learning. Let's say you go to a class and you learn karate, right? Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Everybody understands that you don't just go and just read a book or watch a video and now you know karate. That no, you have to have hands-on experience,
exactly,
with an experienced person who can watch you, see how you're coming, give you feedback. So this feedback loop and the wisdom of someone who knows the path, that's always been a part of our educational system. And it's just that we have kind of lost the, even in the public school system, even, we kind of lost that. So, you know, it was the way that it started was, you know, if you grew up in traditional societies, you grew up in, you know, you learn from your parents directly. You know, you go out and they take you out to the barn, they show you how to take care of the animals, how to get milk, how to get eggs from the, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you have to actually be on the spot, walking around, being there, doing it, having them yell at you, don't put your foot in that, get out of this, you know. So they're warning
right,
you about certain
right.
dangers, you know, snakes in there, all that's going on, you know. So that's really what an education is. So given that we don't have, often we don't have that set up, that means it's upon the person who understands that it is about learning and it is about mastery, that you go find a master teacher in your
mm-hmm.
area or in some area and you hook up with them. And, you know, it's amazing, as much as I've been involved. Now, I've been involved in business ever since I was in grad school, you know. And I've always had, even I started out in my private practice, and I had other businesses since. But, you know, it very rarely do business students come and talk to me, even let alone hang out, about
right.
business and, you know, what kind of issues have I gone through, what have I learned, you know, how did I deal with banks? I mean, these are all things that when you try to do business that, you know, you need to know about. But it's not
right.
too often. More often I have students from other areas that come, and I encourage them. They're not necessarily even looking into business. And I encourage them, while in the meantime, while you're getting your degree, start your business, you know.
Right.
Because that mentor relationship provides all kinds of things for you as a human being that you really don't appreciate it initially. You appreciate it over time as you mature, that
right.
being around a mature person and having that wisdom. And a lot of times, again, it's that they can keep you from going through a lot of problems that you know, on the learning curve that you are going to go through unless you have that mentor let you know, don't do that, man, I already did that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very important part of being successful. And while I mention that, let me say, since I got your ear there, let me say that there's a big difference between thinking about being successful, wanting to be successful, and committing to be successful. It's a big difference.
Yes.
And I have gone into the college classroom and I have asked the question, okay, how many of you all want to be successful? And almost everyone will raise their hand. Everybody won't, but almost everyone will. And then when I ask the second question, how many of you are committed to being successful? And you know what? Only a few hands will go up.
Right.
Only a few hands will go up. So no matter what area you're in, no matter what you're doing, one should commit to being successful. One should commit to being good. One should commit to being excellent. You know, that's one of the things that Martin Luther King is known for, and he talked about when he said, you know, if you're going to be a street sweeper, you know, be the best street sweeper. He's talking about commit yourself to life. Don't just be here floating through, but actually make it your work. Our lives should be about work. And definitely the reality of life, the laws of life, the way it's set up, means that when you're about work, that there will be resistance to progress. And that's no different than in physics. When you try to move an object through space, there's resistance, you know. And so you have to embrace the law. The fact is that there is going to be resistance. You're going to have troubles. You're going to do the wrong thing sometimes. You learn that, you know, having problems, falling, coming into barriers, all these things happen. And what it does is it teaches you to expand your intelligence and to expand your fortitude. And then after you get past those barriers, now you've seen how spirit works. Now you've seen how God works. The
yes.
fact is that the whole time you always had it within yourself to accomplish. So you just keep doing that. And through that, you gain confidence, you gain fearlessness, you gain more intelligence, and you make better connections with life. And that's what it's all about.
And see, nuggets like that, again, it's like the icing on the cake of as to why you are cherished within our community, but also just that mentorship, that relationship between the elder, the person who has the knowledge and experience and is tried and true, versus the person with the unproven resume. Because I don't see myself as a highly accomplished person, but I do see myself as an accomplished person. But being able to have conversations with those younger than me, and like you said, the wide-eyed ambition. Because as you were speaking, I was thinking about my time in your industrial psychology class, and you had us do an assignment where we had to create a business or create an idea that,
absolutely.
That we could put into play. And
absolutely.
I still remember, because I think often about that scenario in the assignment that you gave us, because it helped me in my life as an entrepreneur as well, to being able to think outside the box. And as I ride
yes.
through the city, I think about that assignment often, because I see new businesses pop up, and also understanding that everything around me was once an idea in somebody's mind until they put themselves
absolutely.
In alignment with that, what they wanted. And that's how, like, when you talk about that spirit, that's how that's happening. And now, as you can say, also as you said, when you mature through time, it starts to crystallize itself, starts to become clearer. And once again, that's the importance of having somebody there to help you, to teach you, to guide you, because I may not have to go through 15 bumps in a row like you did, and I could put myself in the position to truly help myself and others, being having that person in that position. Yes, sir. Definitely understand that.
Absolutely. And you are doing that. I mean, you have created already these venues and also these collaborations. Like, I was listening to, you were talking about the different people that you're involved in, even with your project, you know. Yes. And that's what it's all about, that you realize that we're not independent, you know. We are right. interdependent. We interact with each other, and we depend on each other for support. So synergy,
yes.
a group of people all working together, is much better than just me by myself, always.
Yes,
you know, that's the human way, you know. And so, yeah, I remember that. Of course, I remember giving you all that assignment. And, you know, the beautiful thing about it for me as an instructor that's also inspirational is how many students, just like you did, how many students have years later told me what an influence that was. And many of them, you'd be surprised to know the number of students who left FAMU and actually created those projects, those very projects that they worked on in class, that they mm-hmm. actually created those projects.
Yes, sir. Thank
you. And they
you.
Come through, you know,
Thank
homecoming
you.
And all, and they tell me, and it's amazing. It's amazing. It always comes down to ideas, right?
Yes.
That's a very good point that you made, that you say, and you look around, and I would encourage our listeners, yeah, look around, start out just in your house.
Mm-hmm.
Just look at all the different things you have in your house, and remember, everything you have in your house had to be made by somebody.
Right.
Somebody had to produce that. And then you drive down the street, and you look at all the different types of businesses, thousands of them just here in Tallahassee, and think mm-hmm. all the cities you go to, and you see all these businesses. Somebody had to think of it. Then they had to pursue that idea. Then they had to commit to it so that the spirit of life could flow into their world and bring that business about. And this is our direct contact with God. You know, people,
yes,
even God, you know, same thing. People talk about God, and a lot of times they talk about God on Sunday, and then they forget about God for the rest of the week.
Right.
And God is all present, active at all times, doing what God does, which is constantly in the state of creation. So we are
right.
co-creators in the universe,
mm-hmm.
and the universe is waiting. You know, God is waiting on us to take action to put things in place, not for us to be begging and crying, because this is actually not the teaching. If you look at all, and I study all religious teaching,
yes.
and when we study all religious teaching, fundamentally all the teachings tell us that the God, however we want to think of it, whatever we want to call it, all the different names that people use around the world for this phenomenon, that ultimately the God is the source of everything, and that we have to, putting our faith in it, meaning not that we just sit back and do nothing and wait for something to happen, but rather that we boldly go forward, you know, say, even in the shadow of the valley of death, you know, I'll fear no evil. You know, you go into life with this seed, this idea, and make this idea become reality. And if we can do that, and when we do that, we will see that we do not have to accept this dependency that we are stuck in at this time.
That's correct. That is definitely correct, because I'm able to see it, and it's just so clear. And I don't know, I hated school growing up, and even to
yeah.
this day I cringe about my memories of school. But until I got to FAM, like, I had fun in high school, but it still wasn't a pleasurable place to be. But sitting in these classes at FAMU, being able to learn from you and all the other great professors of the psychology program, which I feel is one of the best programs ever, it was a pleasure. It was a privilege of mine to be able to enjoy learning, because it was the first time in my life that I enjoyed learning, and the fact that I was able to come out of that program not with just a better understanding of the system of white supremacy, how psychology was used in the system of white supremacy, but a sense of self, knowledge of self. And it's to people like you who, when you talk about a commitment to success, you made a commitment to be successful but that commitment also extended out to us. So definitely, definitely appreciate you doing that, sir. Definitely appreciate. Now,
excellent.
One of my favorite restaurants in this city is your restaurant, Nefertari's. And
well, thank you.
Always telling people about it. Every chance I get when somebody's coming to Tallahassee, I remember even when the group Oshun was coming to do their concert, I was on the Instagram and they were asking what restaurants should we eat in Tallahassee? Come to Nefertari's. I love the atmosphere, and I just love what you guys do. So could you tell our audience more about Nefertari's and how you came up with the idea and just all what you guys bring to the table as a restaurant?
Okay, thank you. First of all, this is my second restaurant. I had the first internet cafe in Tallahassee back in the 90s.
Okay.
And I personally, I'm actually vegan now, but I was a vegetarian for most all my adult life. So we had a restaurant that was a vegetarian restaurant back in the 90s. And one of the things that I had a lot of meat eaters that were patrons. You know, they were there all the time, but they would always tell me they couldn't bring their friends because their friends, as soon as they heard there was a vegetarian restaurant, and they were meat eaters. They said, "Oh, they got nothing for me to eat."
Yeah.
So we decided we were looking forward to opening a new restaurant, a little bit more upscale, and so we decided this time that we were going to stay with the healthy food concept that we do, but we also were going to open it up so that if meat eaters wanted to come eat with their friends, that we would also address them, you know, that we'd have food that they would like. So the first issue for us is really health, the fact that, you know, again, we are scientists, and so we look at the numbers, and so what do we see? We see that in the black community that we lead the nation in most biological diseases. And the ones that are taking us out, heart disease, and especially now colon cancer, which is the number one killer of black women in the United States. And colon cancers directly tied back to this terrible diet of junk that we tend to eat in this society. And over the last 15 years, just watching the results, watching the research, watching the increase in disease processes, diabetes, of course, is the other one, we realized that something had happened to the food, that it wasn't just simply that people were all of a sudden seeing more and more of these diseases, but rather it's actually in the food. And I went ahead and looked like I do, because the whole point of, you know, education is learning how to be informed, right? How to be educated, how to get knowledge.
Right.
And so I took the same skills that I used in my other fields and applied it to the food area. And so, you know, all the results will show that the food has changed. There's more poison in the food than ever before. They have viruses now that they put in certain types of foods. You know, the Monsanto products are virus-laden foods. And so these different poisons and viruses are actually killing people. That's the only way I can put it. It's killing people, you know, causing disease processes. And so our restaurant, we wanted to make sure that we had healthy food. So we don't use most of the corporate products of the big corporations where they use cheap and poison food because it makes a good profit for them. So it's mostly fresh food. It's mostly organic. As much as possible, I try to get organic food. Definitely not genetically modified food. And then we have an array. We're also international, so we have food items from all around the world. I like to cook, and I like to eat different types of food. And so we have a truly international menu. We have everything from a raw dish, which is all uncooked, you know, raw food, vegetable-based plate, through vegan. We have a lot of vegan plates, cooked foods, through lacto-vegetarian. So we have some products. You can get eggs in it or even cheese if you want it. We also have vegan products that you can – it looks like what people are used to eating, with cheese and eggs, doesn't have any of that in it at all. We have our vegan mac is considered the best in the world by everybody. It has no milk or cheese in it at all. It's hard to tell, but it has none. Right up to we have lamb, shrimp. We have the most popular dish is actually a Greek red snapper. So, you know, we have a variety of different dishes. I cook a lot of East Indian, Thai, Mexican, Southern Louisiana. We have food and even a little bit of what we call Southern cooking, black Southern cooking. But the point is that we try to make sure that it's healthy. And the other thing about it is when you say vegan and plant-based diet, people tend to think of salad, or they tend to think of very flavorless dishes, you know.
Yeah.
And that's because a lot of times that's what it is, flavorless dishes. I went to a place, I'm not going to tell you where it was. I went to a place to try out a new place and got some vegan food. And when I ate that food, I tell you, I said, see, this is why people don't want to eat vegan food right here. It really had no flavor. That's not happening in Neftaris. We put a premium on flavor. We say we want our customers to eat the food and go, wow, we call the wow factor. It's not what they expected, that it just blows their head off. And that's also, we make all of our desserts here. And so probably the most popular desserts are definitely cheesecakes. My wife makes all types of cheesecakes and from different types of fruits and nuts and things. And also I make different pies. They're all vegan. And, you know, again, it's hard to describe because people are surprised. Again, people come here from all over the world and from different big cities around like New York and Miami. And people say, man, this place should be in New York or it should be in Miami. Or you need to come. You need to open up an Neftaris in Finland. You know, I get this all the time. It's a unique place. It's upscale. Yes, it is. And the other thing is when you come into my restaurant, you're going to notice that I embrace my African culture.
Definitely.
Unapologetically. And, you know, all of our, we have an Egyptian motif in our place because I identify a lot with that culture. But it is both a dining experience. It is both about that food and that flavor, but it's also about that environment.
Yes,
so we have a lot of, like I'm sitting in the room right now when I'm talking to you. I'm sitting there. We have a special dining room that seats up to 24. I got a big crowd coming in today. They'll be taking up this room. We also do catering. We do special events. And I even have had some super birthday parties in here. We had over 100 guests. But somebody actually rented the whole place for a birthday party. I've done that a couple of times. We also have coming up in October, we're going to have another dinner theater. We do that periodically. People have been asking about it. So we have dinner theater. It's a six-course meal. We have a whodunit type of it's like a play, but it's not on the stage. It's happening right there in the restaurant. You know, it's just a fun night for something different for grown folks to do. And also on Tuesday night, we have Black on Black Rhyme with Mr. Keith Rogers. Every Tuesday night, we've been here since 2005. It's been here. That's where it's open mic, and we also have seasoned vet poets. But people can come in. They can sign up. They can do their poetry. If you've never done poetry but you have a desire to it, it's a great thing to come up and just get on the stage. That's another arena where we have created a venue where people can come and they can test out an audience. We have sometimes even comics even come here sometimes and do comedy. A lot of people, some people I can think of, some of y'all know Royce Lovett, you know, first time he ever played publicly was right here. So we have artists, we have several artists that are out there in the field that have started out right here on stage at what's now called Neftaris. And, of course, we still have the bookstore here also for people who are still trying to find those rare books that we all need to be reading about Black history and culture.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I appreciate you for allowing me to have my book in your store. So, yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I've got that book. Come on in.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, keep it going. keep it going, because one of the things, the reason I ended up with the bookstore in the first place was I was driving through, Houston, back mm-hmm. in the 80s, driving through Houston. I stopped off at the Shrine of the Black Madonna in Houston.
Okay.
And I had no idea that many black people had written that many books, that they were out there,
right.
actually out there available to people to read.
Right.
And I was so smitten by it. And then we got to Los Angeles, and there was another Black Interest bookstore just opening, Isawan. And then the oldest one, Aquarian Bookstore, was also in Los Angeles. So, you know, we were steeped in all these books. And so we decided, when we decided we were coming back to Tallahassee, we said, well, the first thing we got to do is we got to have a bookstore so that the people who understand the need and the value of these books can come in and find them, because you cannot find them at Borders and other places like that.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Definitely. And speaking of, about the going back to the restaurant, the live, I think it was the live fruit pie I had once. It had different types of fruits on it, and
raw fruit pie.
Yes, that. I still dream about that to this day. I love that. And then the Ethiopian stew platter is one of my favorites as well. So, yes, sir.
Yeah, well, this is, again, we have food from around the world, and this is the only place probably within, I don't know how many miles, 250 miles maybe, that you could find Ethiopian food.
Exactly.
And that's just
exactly.
one of the type of food that we have. But, yeah, that's a very popular dish. Every night, that's a very popular dish.
Yes. So if you're ever in Tallahassee, you have to come to Nefertari. As a matter of fact, you call me and I'll take you. That's how we'll do that.
You have to.
So, yes, sir. So I want to ask you this question before we wrap this up. Your book, The Reascension of the Black Man's Mind, Coming Forth by Ra.
Yes.
Why did you? Because even just looking at the cover of the book, and I know when they read the book, you explain the cover. But this is a great book, by the way. I recommend people to read it.
Well, thank you.
Why did you write this book? Because you're telling your life story. You're talking about you and your coming into consciousness and the effects that it has had.
Yes.
Also, you're breaking down the system of white supremacy. So what led to you writing this book?
Well, you know, there's the explainable side of that, and then there's the unexplainable side of it.
Right.
So the explainable side of it is I have been reading all these books, and I personally have been influenced by the work of so many writers. And I have a love of books and reading. And so in my area, you know, by becoming a professor in the end, which, you know, the funny part of that is I told you I came from a family of teachers, mm-hmm. but as a young man, I claimed that I would never be a teacher. I had made that proclamation. I'm never going to be a teacher. I thought teachers worked too hard.
Right.
Because I saw my mom and all of them, how much they worked. But as it turns out, the unexplainable side of it is, of course, that my destiny was to be a teacher. And that's the spiritual aspect of my life, and I had to find that out. I didn't know that. I was like Dorothy on the way to the Wizard of Oz, you know.
Yes.
And then when I get to Oz, I find out that, you know, this is what I'm doing. This is why I'm here. The thing that I said I wasn't going to do is the very thing that I was born to do. And so as a teacher, I look for all methods of teaching. And also, like, I'm a filmmaker, too. I just finished my mm-hmm. second film. That's just another method of teaching for me. And so part of it is a spiritual awakening, even the fact that I even wrote the book. And, you know, it's funny, when I was writing the book, initially I had one idea. It was very academic initially, the way that I started writing that book. And then over time, as I continued to be open to, well, what do I need to say and how do I need to say it and what are these chapters going to be about, et cetera, I was influenced, I would say, by those who passed on before me, who I am in touch with, and they influenced me. to write certain things that I really was kind of ambivalent about writing, like, should I even go there, you know? And there was a very, very strong spiritual presence throughout all of that time telling me, no, you have to write this. And so that part is a lot more difficult to explain. It's the unexplainable side of that, say. But I was compelled to write that book. And the other part of it was an awareness that there is a shift taking place, and I was aware of it then. It's more obvious, I think, to more people now, that this 400-year cycle of oppression of the black and brown people of the world, that cycle is coming to an end. And I was aware of it then. That's why it's called the reawakening, because, you know, again, we forget that for almost all of human history, that really that black people had set the pace of what humanity is, that we created all of these structures of education, government, society, et cetera. We were already doing all of that. We were already running worlds before we got invaded. See, so what I'm saying is that this shift that's taking place, and nothing can stop it because it's bigger than our interests. This is the planet. That's how it's going to go. And so because I can see that, and also because, again, just the great information that had been shared with me, I felt that, and also I know how it's going to happen to other people, that people are going to find themselves very uncomfortable with the way things are and find themselves questioning all of the structures that are already in place that hold this whole white supremacy domination system together, that people were going to start questioning that. And a generation was going to come along and say, I don't believe in all this nonsense. That was coming. And so really that's what I wrote that book for those who are waking up and realizing that we live in a world that is a culture of make-believe, fake-believe. And then there's the real world, and that real world is the spiritual world. And I had to come to that understanding, and I know it was a very unusual and strange route. And so I know that usually when that happens to people, it's strange and it's difficult, and they try to share it with their family or other people, and nobody's trying to hear them, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what made me just say, okay, I'm going to make this very, very public. And I know for a lot of people it makes them uncomfortable. But for the people who are waking up, they need to have, it's almost like you talked about that mentorship earlier, they need to have someone to validate the weird experiences that they're having that's right. A part of waking up from this shell of mental oppression that our people have been under for so long. It's like Neo in the Matrix, you know, coming out of that egg, you know, and feeling weird and finding out the world is different from what you thought it was.
Yes, definitely. Like you said, those who have gone through these experiences have definitely helped me, because getting a chance to be around the information for a while. I know high school, I just thought I was weird. And I just thought that a lot of things that I thought, certain things just didn't make sense to me, and I couldn't explain why. Certain experiences I would have, certain dreams, continuous dreams I would have, certain things. So being able to get around black people who didn't act white but still embraced differences in life was huge for me, because I was able to really see the vastness of our culture as black people in this country of America, but also I was exposed to the vastness of the African diaspora and just how different but similar we are. And I'm not the only one having these experiences, because I'm not the only one that's waking up.
Yes, that's very important. How vast and how different and similar we are. Exactly.
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
yes, sir.
Exactly. The culture is still there, no matter how different we may seem on the surface.
Exactly.
The culture is still there. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's the culture that gets oppressed.
Exactly. I have one quick question. It just popped in my mind. Because I've run across a lot of young people who you know, they have so much information thrown at them. You know, we even have a group of people who really believe the earth is flat and all these things here. But when we're coming across different mediums and people who are claiming that black people in America don't have a connection to Africa, that we are this group, we're that group, we're this group, as a person who has a pretty good background, a solid background in history, what information or what advice would you give to those young people who have questions about all this different information that they're getting about their connection to the African continent?
Well, you know, that whole, I mean, you know, it's a state of ignorance that is almost hard to even look at, you know. It's like, how could you not notice, you know,
that
we are African people, you know. But the point is that, you know, the whole dynamic of global supremacy by white folks requires everyone to be ignorant of what really happened in the world. Because as soon as you look at the world and see what happened, you will realize that there's no supremacy at all. You would realize that, see? Mm-hmm. So, you know, Malcolm used to try to explain that to people, you know. But the point is that I recognize the fact that we are in a state of ignorance, that we don't have that knowledge. And we are not responsible for the school system because the training of the knowledge of life and the definitions of reality are all happening early on in the school system.
Right.
And so, you know, you're taught nonsense. You know, it's just like being taught that you live in a democracy. You know, this is not a democracy, you know.
Right.
It's a term, democracy. This is not, we have never lived in a democracy. And even so, you could be told you live in a democracy, and you could be told about freedom and justice and righteousness and all of that, and the Bill of Rights and all of that, at the same time being told that these men who wrote this stuff on paper supposedly also enslaved your people.
Right.
Right. And we're supposed to hold them up as some founding fathers of democracy, right? So that is obviously a big lie. So if that big lie can go on every day and people can respond to that, then what else is a big lie that people are responding to? So the idea that somehow if you take a rabbit and take that rabbit and relocate that rabbit downtown, that now it's no longer a rabbit.
Right.
You know, because you moved it, you know.
Right.
Or because, you know, you you took it out of the cage and let it free in the field, and once it's in the field, it's no longer a rabbit, or vice versa,
right.
You know. So it's so many obvious lies that we embrace that, and then it's passed on intergenerational. You know, institutions are for maintaining intergenerational cultural knowledge. That's the point of an institution. So if you're not running the education institution, then you're not ensuring that the next generation gets the knowledge and the culture.
Right.
And that's all that we're dealing with. So I just, you know, when people, you know, of course, when I was in the college campus, I mean, up there teaching classes, I mean, that's an ongoing discussion, isn't it? All the time, you know. I've had, you know, the darkest, blackest person in class arguing me down. I'm not African. And, you know, my simple question is, where you get your blackness from?
Correct.
You know, it's like, and I will say to the person, you know, breaking through the obvious lie, I will say, man, you sure are dark-skinned to be saying you're not African. Where you get that skin from?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've had, literally had college students to sit there, ponder that, look at me and say, I see what you mean, literally. So it's really just about always speaking the truth. That's the main thing.
Exactly.
We call this cognitive dissonance. When in psychology we call it cognitive dissonance, when information is coming to you that doesn't fit into your frame of reference that you already have. there's a tendency to push that information out and discredit it. That's what happens. Happens all the time. And there has to be some type of adjustment within the person for them to embrace and somehow utilize the new information. And that takes time. You don't just do that in a day. So that's why I just keep going on, keep plugging away, keep showing up, keep having that conversation, keep opening those questions. You know, I can relate to you very well. You know, I told you, you know, and see in my book I wrote, look, I was 7 years old in church asking some serious questions at age seven that people could not answer. You know, and I didn't get those answers until I was 19. So, you know.
Yes, sir.
So there was something there in me that was always asking those questions, whatever that was.
Right? Exactly.
So I know, the bottom line is, I know that behind all the foolishness, no matter what people have been through, what drug treatment did for me when I work with thousands, and I have helped to get thousands of people off of drugs and alcohol, thousands. And what it showed me was that no matter how crazy a person looked and no matter how bad their life had gotten, that behind that was always that spirit, you know, that soul was always there. And once people embrace that and turn that thing on, they are capable of overcoming all odds. And I watched so many people. I had, you know, drug addicts, people have been using heroin on the street for like 15 years. Mm-hmm. That's all they do all day is go out and steal and prostitute or do whatever they can to get their heroin. And I watch those same people within 6 months become completely different, upstanding citizens. And so that taught me that the spirit is always stronger than the foolishness that you see. And so I always operate from that point. And when I deal with people on a daily basis, day in and day out, I'm dealing with them at the spiritual level because I know that the spiritual level of the person is the true level, is the true person. And when you speak to that, it has to respond. That's where I go.
Yes, sir. So this is the very, very, very last question I want to ask. And this question, we ask to everyone. This is our standard question we ask to everyone. If you were the all-powerful ruler of Black America, what would you change? What would your message be?
If I was the all-powerful ruler, what I would change definitely is I would change the way that we go about educating the next generation, definitely. Yes. And my message would be teach the truth.
Yes.
Help to rear, like the old folks say, that you have to rear. And when they say it rear, that means that you provide like a vessel, you know, you provide the context where this human being has the best chance of understanding life and truly expressing the gift that they have brought to the world. Everybody born has the gift that they have brought to the world. A lot of times people don't even get to unwrap that gift because of the oppression that's all around them. So part of that is you've got to understand the power of culture, and that has to be taught, and the educational system should be based in the culture of the people that you're educating.
Yes, sir. Just real quick, where can people reach you social media-wise? Where can people reach you to be able to contact you, and how can they get more information about Nefertari's in your bookstore?
Okay. So Nefertari's is also online. We have a website, Nefertaris, Nefertaris.com. And they'll see on there, they'll see, we can see the menu on there. You see I have galleries of pictures of food, also some of the activities that we have. And the phone number, of course, is there, which is 850-210-0548. If they forget, they can go Google it. It's on Google. We're on Facebook. I'm on Facebook. You can find me just by going to my name on Facebook. Also, I have a website, which is www.aakhetorld.com. And there is an email address there also. Most of the time I'm here at the restaurant. Most of the time. But yeah, but they can, and most of the people that I'm in touch with, people all over the world every day. I have conversations with people. I do a lot of dream analysis, and people know that, and they contact me online. So probably the fastest way to get me, to get my attention, is on Facebook probably. Okay. At least for right now, until they figure out what they're going to do with Facebook.
Exactly. You got to keep up with that.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
You got to keep up with that. Yeah.
Yes, sir. I truly appreciate your time, your wisdom, and everything. Like I said in the beginning, the work that you've done in this community has definitely had a profound impact upon myself, especially my entrepreneurial pursuits. And just on behalf of all of the students that you've had, thank you for the decisions that you've made, for following your instinct, for following your passions, because it's definitely made an impact on Tallahassee's community and the students who've been able to come through FAMU. I know myself, when I entered the psychology program, I had no idea what I wanted to do with myself in the world. I was lost. The football thing wasn't going on, so I had no idea. But being able to see true black excellence right before my eyes really helped me be able to get on my path and find my purpose in life. And I just want to be able to, I just want to say thank you for everything that you have done and the things that you continue to do. And just want to let you know that the Freedom Train platform is here as support. So we welcome you back at any time. And I'm not going to take up no more of your time, but I did want to let you know how we feel and the appreciativeness that we have. And just thank you for being on here with us today.
Well, you're quite welcome, sir, and I appreciate your generosity in sharing those things. And, of course, very excited about your work. And always, when I see young people doing what they're inspired to do and continuing to grow and take it, and I know you will, you know, okay. I feel like, yeah, maybe something that I have offered the world, maybe it was a value, you know. So it's a feedback loop. And so reciprocity is very important in African culture. I give, you give, I receive, you receive, each one teach one. And you're doing the work, and that is the responsibility of life. And so salute to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And I'm not going to take up no more of your time.
Right,
so, yes, sir, I'll definitely speak to you again. All right. Thank you.
All right, brother. Thank you very much. We're off to work.
Sir.
Peace.
Yes, sir. All right, people, that was Dr. Dana Denard. And go to Facebook, type in his name, you can find him. Remember, Nefertari's Fine Cuisine and Spirits, www.nefertari's.com, NEFETARIS.com. Bomb restaurant, bomb food. And you know me, I don't blow smoke. So everything that was just exchanged, definitely genuine. And if you ever have a chance to come to Tallahassee, holla at me so I could take you to Nefertari so we can both eat. You know how we do it, man. This is the Freedom Train podcast series, your premier, the premier black media outlet for black America. We're growing. We're glowing, and we're doing our best to make sure that we connect the community with the best resources that we have today. So, amen. It's a blessing to be here, and we got to move forward and do what we need to do. Black pride, black power, black people, and